the yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the podcast about books and literature and other topics sometimes. The only book club you want to join is our little tagline. I'm Aaron Black. I'm here with Dave Durr.
Hello.
We got Brick over here.
Hello.
This is our
second
book club episode.
I think we need to differentiate these somehow.
Oh, how would you like to do that?
I don't know, comics club and story club or something.
Okay, story club. So the first story club episode. We've been talking about comics a couple times, but this is our first journey into the wilds of short fiction. And Dave, why don't you tell us more about this?
Really into the wilds, especially with Hunters in the Snow.
Oh my God.
So I've been reading some Toby Wolf. We're going to call him Toby. Some Tobias Wolf.
Quote unquote, we are.
And two stories jumped out at me as, I guess, sharing a similarity in a way. Hunters in the Snow and Bullet in the Brain. Mm. Both coming from, I guess, the 80s and 90s. I should have looked up the dates, but...
Bullet in the Brain was 95, I think they said.
Bullet in the Brain, yeah. In the New Yorker, and Hunters in the Snow. I'm not sure where that was first published, but... Brain. I came here fully unprepared, in other words.
Yeah, it's a book club.
Yeah. I guess first question is, what did you babies think of it? One of us has walked away, so.
Singular baby. Like we were talking earlier, I read these in undergrad, but I think both of them in undergrad at some point.
For classes.
Yeah, because I think, so Tobias Wolf did come to my undergrad at some point, and I think we read Hunters in the Snow in preparation for that, potentially.
Oh, and discussed it with him?
I think so. Ooh. I want to say maybe.
Yeah.
I recall almost nothing about it, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I remember he was there, and he was very nice. And then Bullet in the Brain I read, I think, in a fiction workshop later after that. They're both great stories, obviously. They're celebrated for a reason. But I had a reaction to Hunters in the Snow this time that I didn't have before, which is I thought was really funny.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't know if I ever picked up on that the first time, and probably it's just immaturity on my part as a reader, but I was laughing, mm-hmm. and at least inside, I wasn't like... There's no like real chuckles here, but it's like it's a really funny story, and that surprised me.
I'm not sure I'd call it really funny, but it's definitely got some dark humor.
Yeah,
especially once Kenny is shot, and they sort of treat him as if he were a deer that they had shot successfully. Yeah. They just like kind of dump him in the pickup, in the bed of the pickup, and some of the things they say to him are very funny.
Yeah,
definitely in a super dark way, obviously, but.
And the sudden shift from the urgency of we just shot someone, we need to get him to the hospital, to I'm thinking about leaving my wife and I'm having sex with a 15-year-old babysitter, and I'm actually really fat. I don't have a gland problem. I've been like this obvious lie that they've been telling. It becomes this like strange soap opera domestic drama in some way while a man is dying in the back of a truck. And it's funny. It's really funny.
So this story, it was a little hard for me to interpret, which I don't remember thinking that way. Because I remembered this story and I remember what happened, but I don't know if it's a... Like, you ever watch Dumb and Dumber as an adult and you realize it's a really sick and twisted story and not all that funny?
Right.
Yeah, they kind of leave him in the back like he's a deer, but it seems like Kenny's trying to kill him. Or Frank. I get their names confused. Which one's the one that gets shot?
Kenny.
Kenny gets shot, yeah.
All right, so it seems like Frank is wanting him to die to cover up him blabbing about him being a pedophile. Right? So it's this time around, I interpreted as he was purposefully not going to the hospital and killing time with Tub,
right?
So that his friend would die because his friend's going around telling everyone that he's fucking the 15-year-old babysitter,
right?
And now his secret is with Tub.
So then the problem I have with the story is why did he tell Tub?
Because
Tub asked once, and then Tub's clearly dumb enough that when he said "Don't worry about it," he just talks too much. Tub probably would have never said it again.
Well, Tub shares his shameful secret with Frank too, so they kind of have that, I guess, in a way, on each other.
Maybe,
like,
but
the
then,
implication
but
being
then,
that if Tub spills what he knows about Frank, then Frank can say, "Well, I'm gonna, you know, tell your wife and everybody
but
to work with."
That all could have happened without Frank then spilling his beans about how much he loved her and how she's really an adult. You know what I mean? Like, why is Frank an idiot too?
Well, yeah, I think he
Why does Frank confess everything to Tub?
I think, I guess so.
It's like, is he going to kill Tub?
I don't think so. I saw it as more of they are the shift from kind of like the broken machismo of going hunting and sort of it's kind of like picking on people, constant sort of being on you know, someone else's nerve back or whatever, then turns into this like, warm, almost like obnoxiously warm revelation period where the two characters are sort of bearing their deepest secrets and they sort of have this intimacy, right? The contrast between being out in the woods hunting and being sort of like stereotypical, like dumb men, to kind of being almost equally stereotypical, like blubbering men, right? It's a weird transition. And I guess I didn't get the first time that Frank was doing it deliberately. I'm not sure that I got that.
I don't remember thinking that when I read it previously.
I mean, this time either.
But this time, I mean, it's hard not to think that Frank is purposely wanting his friend to die.
I don't know. I didn't catch that.
Like the four plates of pancakes, and then he doesn't go to the hospital. Right. Is he supposed to just forget he's in the back of the truck? Is that what it's supposed to be? Like, I don't get it. I'm not sure how to read it.
I think with the pancakes, Frank is sort of forcing Tub to indulge himself in this like sort of secret, I don't know, shame, I guess, and in a way, giving Frank is getting permission from Tub then to like continue indulging in his own.
Mm. But why does that need to happen while their friend is actively bleeding out?
I think because that's funny.
But is it funny? But what is that? How do we interpret that as a story? Because he very easily could have taken his friend to the hospital and then gone to get pancakes, and that whole plot would have worked out exactly the same.
Right.
But one of them is actively participating in the death of your friend, and one of them, or hunting partner, whatever he is, and one of them's not.
Right.
Yeah. And even an idiot like Frank is going to know that if someone dies while you're hunting with them, there's trouble coming your way.
Right. And if you're trying to cover up your crime, like stopping in front of witnesses at multiple rest stops.
Exactly. So is he just like really stupid? Like, I just don't know how to interpret it.
I guess I don't know that it's really stupid, but I think that I guess my explanation or my interpretation there is that the story leaves so same realistic urgency, right? And becomes this kind of more weird comedic beat that doesn't have those same ties anymore.
Intentionally comedic, you think?
I think, yeah. That all of a sudden, the humor of them sort of like bonding and Kenny dying in the truck, it's a different story almost, right?
I still think you could have all that without him dying.
You couldn't have the comedy of it, probably.
It's just as funny for them to have, that's a very traumatic experience,
yeah.
And to nonchalantly just like leave him out front of a hospital and go and chow on pancakes and do that. I don't think their arc changes all that much. But the fact that they're letting their friend die is a very major choice. That's a weird choice.
I think it's weird. I think you're right. It's definitely weird. And that's why it's funny. I think if they had gone to the hospital and dumped him off and gone to eat pancakes, it would be funny for sure. But the humor is heightened by the stakes of him actively dying in the back of that truck. Right, it's like the further it gets away from any sort of recognizable motivations or human behavior, the funnier it is.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Because like, there's no way they should be doing this, right? There is no rational explanation for why these two men would behave this way when their friend's dying.
There is, though. The rational explanation is he's wanting his friend to die. That's the thing. So
right.
If it were actually totally divorced from reality, it wouldn't.
But the
rational thing is by making that choice, he is turning a hunting accident into a murder.
Right, but then your question about telling Tub the same story sort of begins to erode that reading.
Or is telling me he's just getting it off his chest because he's going to kill his friend next.
He's going to kill Tub?
Yeah. I don't see why that's not a logical next step, right? Tub shot his friend, right? Or he's trying to pin up his friend or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to... Because it's funny, but it never breaks from reality.
I think it does.
It doesn't, though. I mean, those are, you know, it's like Fargo, right? It's funny,
yes, yeah.
And dark, but it doesn't break from reality.
It has that Coen Brothers sense of a realistic absurdity, right?
Right, but the cops still come and arrest people, and people die, and like it doesn't. It's not actually absurd. It just kind of mimics the absurd.
Right, but not everyone's reactions always add up to what you think they should be, right? Like, cops will come and arrest people. They won't have the same reactions necessarily. They won't be real cops. They won't sort of have the same sort of cop attention to whatever.
But their actions do, right? So like in Fargo, the words, what's good about that, I think, is sometimes the words and the reactions break from the expected.
Right.
But the actions and the reality don't. Right, the things are silly and weird, and the way they do things is strange.
Right,
but if you change the entire dialogue of that movie, it would still make sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So by going down, the choice he makes to have the pancakes turns it into murder.
Right.
So which
he wouldn't be responsible.
Right. It turns it into someone else's murder.
He'd be an accessory, but...
Right? He's not turning it into his own murder. He's forcing Tub to be a murderer by making him go have pancakes.
Right.
That's not a joke. That's a criminal act. Right? He's taking advantage of his dumb, fat friend who will sit and eat four pancakes while the person who he shot died. So then Frank can go and hang a murder on his friend Tub. So he's either going to kill him or he's going to turn him in, I'm forced to interpret that choice of decisions.
What would be his purpose for hanging the murder on Tub, like getting Tub put away?
Because Tub also knows about the babysitter.
Right, but he could still tell anyone about it.
So if you're bargaining.
Not if he kills him.
But that's not turning him in.
But I think Frank clearly wants his secret to rest with somebody, and so Kenny turned out maybe to be the wrong choice. And then so now
he shares it with Tub,
and he has
If Tub's in jail for killing somebody, why is anyone going to believe him that he's, you know?
Mm, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, it's also like redneck logic, but right. I think the story clearly wants us to see that that's a choice that Frank makes and not just a, ha, 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 let's get pancakes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's a very deliberate choice in how the plot works, right? Because it puts a lot of weight on the decisions. I think if it's just some farcical, we forgot about our friend in the back of the truck and now we're having pancakes, like, isn't this absurd? Like, I think it's not a good story.
Well, also, they're driving away from the hospital. Do you feel like that was an intentional decision on Frank's part, too? Because at one point he says, like, Tub leaves the map at the first place they stop to get coffee, and Frank says, I, you know, memorized it, or I remember how to get there or something. But obviously we learn they're going the wrong way at the end.
Right.
So does Frank know that, or is...
I guess it's up for interpretation, but if this is a story about bumbling rednecks, then I don't think it's a very good story.
It doesn't feel like that's what
It feels like Frank is very... I don't think he planned the shooting, or if he did, that would be something else. But it seems like Frank makes a very deliberate choice to hang a murder on Tub, which I think is some of the strength of the story, but it also leaves questions.
Yeah.
I think when the whole dog thing happens, and then there's the twist where we find out he was supposed to kill the dog, and Tub freaked out and shot him,
right.
I think Frank takes advantage of that situation.
Well, but if...
But then my question is, why did he tell Tub everything? And that's the part that I don't... It's hard to see why he would do both things. He's, like, calculating, but also makes a stupid... You know what I mean?
Right.
I guess if Frank is honest with, for example, the police about what did happen with Kenny, then you could make an argument that Tub was acting in self-defense.
Right.
He legitimately thought... I think Tub legitimately believed that Kenny was about to shoot him.
Yeah. And that case would probably hold up at trial, I think, if you didn't know that someone was going to, the dog was supposed to be killed intentionally.
Right. Assuming that Frank tells.
Assuming he tells the truth.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But that would be.
There's no witnesses at this point, and he thinks he's smarter than Tub. He doesn't like Tub that much. He certainly can tell. It's not like he actually likes him. Right. He treats him like shit and calls him names and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like he didn't used to, though. There's that moment where Tub says.
He used to stick up for you.
Yeah.
And his apology, his turnaround comes pretty quickly. Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. I should reread it with that angle. I didn't see... I guess part of the question is, do we think that covering up that you are in a relationship with a 15-year-old babysitter in rural Washington in the 80s is a murderable crime? Or is a murderable, like, secret? Like, do we believe that Frank would be that desperate to cover that story up to murder two people? Or is he more annoyed that Kenny was shooting his mouth off or whatever?
I mean, do we know whether he... It seems like he voluntarily told Kenny about it. I didn't get the sense that Kenny, like,
yeah,
caught him in the act
offers,
or something.
Offers and then up he, that info.
Yeah, like, Kenny, and then to Tub, too.
Yeah, like, Tub brings it up first, because Kenny does. But Tub also seems perfectly satisfied when he's like, let's just never talk about it again, don't worry, he's got a big mouth.
Right.
So why does he feel the need to... I think the plot goes one way, but it opens up questions for me, which is... It's still a good story, but I think it's hard to interpret.
This feels like a reread kind of story.
Maybe, yeah. In that interpretation, then, he tells Tub, though, that story, or the sort of the secret about the 15-year-old babysitter, then he just is relying on Tub to be sort of the person who will never tell, right?
Which seems like a poor choice.
Yeah, maybe, unless we just believe that Tubb is the kind of character who is that sort of guileless and wouldn't, he was sort of would keep his friend secret, quote-unquote friend, out of a misplaced sense of loyalty.
But even if that's true, what does he get from telling Tubb the story?
Sort of having someone just confide in.
Absolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think also permission to keep fucking the 15-year-old.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Hence the pancakes.
Right.
In that case, that makes sense, but it's still, I still read it as comedy.
It's still funny.
Yeah.
But I think it has to be funny, but also
there's a reason.
There's purposeful. It's absurd, but it's not absurdist, you know?
Right. Outside of plot, what did you make of the sort of language and the writing style here? You know, what do you think of Tobias Wolff as a stylist?
I think the other story does a much better job of demonstrating him as a stylist than this one.
Yeah. Right.
Let's talk about it then. There's a lot of, in Bullet in the Brain, another gun goes off, obviously, as a result of bullying, in a way that Hunters in the Snow, the reason that gun goes off. Yeah, what'd you guys think of Bullet? Also, a lot of humor in it.
Yes.
It's funny.
Yeah, that one's deliberately funny.
And still very, very dark.
Yes. But its humor is more the driving impulse, I think. It's meant to, until it changes, and then it just makes you sort of go kind of
wistful. It's very bittersweet.
Yeah. But, like, all the idea of this, like, writer mouthing off and then getting shot, the way he writes it, it seems like it's driving at, like, this is darkly funny, and then it becomes, like, almost...
Yeah, I mean, he laughs at the robber for being a cliche, and he gets killed for it. It's basically what happens, and then the whole story is sort of flashbacks in his head as he dies.
Yeah.
It's a very short story. It's only a couple pages.
Right.
But I think he does a lot of writing techniques... Well, that themselves could be cliche.
Yes.
Like his character is laughing at, but he pulls them off so that they're not, right?
Mm, like what?
The describing of the flashbacks and like the slow motion is nice, but the way he does it, I really liked when he compared the bullet sluggishness to the synaptic pulses in the brain. Like that's a nice... There's a thousand ways you could describe the speed differences between a bullet and your life flashing before your eyes that wouldn't be as good as that.
Right.
Right. The choice to describe what he doesn't remember is a good way to sort of fit a lot in a short period of time that really has no business being in the story because he doesn't remember it.
Right.
Right. So, like, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
Which, if not done well, I don't think would work very well. I think if maybe any of us tried to do that on our first try, it would fail.
Yeah.
But because he sort of chooses just the right things and just enough, it works, and it sets up the payoff for the final paragraph where it describes what he does remember, which is not that important, right? It's just a moment in a summer in a baseball game.
Well, but
go ahead.
Yeah, a moment where Anders... sort of remembers what he originally liked about language.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, Anders is kind of a fellow critical dick, right? And kind of can't help but wonder if this is maybe a form of like a revenge fantasy, Toby Wolf's part. Like,
yeah.
Well, having a book reviewer killed.
Right. I'm sure. Definitely. But it also felt like a story about writing in that way, right? It's like, it felt like a writer writing about craft, but doing so in a way it's not just like, about a writer.
Yeah, it does.
The obsession with language, even like the pointing out cliches and sort of having that kind of like, I could almost imagine Tobias Wolff writing a story like this and then being sort of disgusted by his own working drafts and then reacting by having a character enact these like cliches and talk about it.
I mean, I feel like this story, the quality of the actual sentence level writing aside, would fail miserably in a workshop.
Why? Because it's too weird.
It's doing a lot in a short amount of time. And I feel like his actual sentence level writing keeps the story from being silly.
Hmm.
Like if you described the story in one sentence, it would sound silly.
But it would sound like a joke.
That's what I mean. Yeah, a joke.
Right. But it kind of is, right?
It is, but it's also, I think it's artful, right? Yes. It's more than a joke. It's a joke that pays off not just with a punchline.
Right.
And I think it would be very easy to have this book pay off with a punchline. But the punchlines come earlier. The punchline gets him killed.
Right. The punchline is the bullet in the brain.
Right. And then the payoff is, like, those last three paragraphs are beautiful. They're really nice, right? The description, the bullet, like, exiting the back of his head, and it says it's a comet trail of memory and hope and talent and love.
Right.
It like blends the real and the not real, the chemical, I mean the electric things that flitter in our brain, but it makes it real as this thing that's spattering out the back of his head.
Yes.
That's a hard thing to describe, let alone depict the way he does.
Yeah, I mean it's a really, I think, masterful example of narrative summary, right? That's sort of last paragraph or a couple paragraphs, we get this, the whole story is in there. And you're right, it would just be a joke without that, and with it, it sort of becomes this kind of beautiful, melancholy thing at the end. But I guess workshop maybe because it seems too, sort of on the face of it, not serious, I suppose.
How many stories have we read in those places, or even written ourselves, that were... I remember when we were a writing group, the entire story I sent you guys, you're like, what's the point of this? I was like, I don't know. I wanted the character's name to be Tessa Tickle. And that was it. And I didn't have a story.
Right.
Like, they all happen.
Right. And this is definitely beyond just a joke.
Yes.
The joke is a vehicle for something sort of different.
Maybe part of it, Wolf trying to write his own way into rediscovering some joy of language, perhaps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it feels autobiographical, right? Mm. This must be about him. What was I going to say? Cliches made me think of this. Especially Bullet in the Brain. Some of the things that happen here feel like they are narrative cliches, but I wonder if that's because this is as generated, and you know, stories like these by other authors, Raymond Carver, for instance. And
it's funny you say Raymond Carver, because the dialogue in Bullet to the Brain sounds like Raymond Carver.
Totally. He must have studied with Carver, right?
It's the same. It doesn't feel natural, but it also doesn't feel stilted. It's hard to...
Yeah.
It's not unnatural, but it feels like late 80s, early 90s short story dialogue.
Yeah, it has that Andre Dubuc mm-hmm. feel to it, right? So things like these might happen in workshop stories or sort of fiction that we sort of like a bit less, and they feel familiar, but they sort of have their origin points here. This feels like sort of like a stylistic touch point for somebody. Probably.
Okay, so what do we see between these two stories? Some similarities, similar themes, anything?
For me, it'd be humor, sort of like the kind of like this wry winking humor.
Yeah, I think that's the big one.
Yeah, violence, I guess, but different kinds of violence. The violence of Hunters in the Snow is almost like sanitized violence, whereas here it's much more like direct, right? Like the descriptions of the bullet in the brain are pornographic almost. Whereas in Hunters in the Snow, the violence is a lot more polite. It's not as rendered as in the Bullet storyline.
I think they both have a pretty clever twist. Bullet in the Brains isn't as twisty because of the title.
Yeah.
Right? But, I mean, the real turning point of Hunters in the Snow is when he kills the dog and then you find out he was supposed to kill the dog.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I think even though it's called Bullet in the Brain, I don't think you're actually expecting him to be shot in the head and then have that narrated the way, like, it's a surprising turn halfway through the story.
Yeah.
And it happens so quickly. I love the way that it happens.
Right.
Yeah, and then...
Let's read that.
Yeah, do it.
Just real quick. So there's some back and forth between Anders and the robbers, and Anders is giving the robbers some shit for these things. He's like, calling him Bright Boy, and then he says, capiche. So Anders bursts out laughing because he just, like, he's at a point in his life, it seems, where he can't help but critique everything.
Yeah. He's that jaded. And that's, to me, that's also the voice of the author being like, this is how much I am fed up with my own writing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so so Anders is laughing and he says, capiche, oh God, capiche, mocking the robber. And at that, the man with the pistol raised the pistol and shot Anders right in the head.
Yeah.
Just boom.
Yeah. And then this like symphony of descriptions of the bullet entering the brain, like all through the entire anatomy of the brain, it goes on. It's endless.
Yeah.
And well, it's not literally endless, but it's
but it feels endless to him, and it's described that way,
right?
You know, whereas, says it's not going to be endless, but it might as well be for Anders, right?
Yeah. Whereas in Hunters in the Snow, he gets shot, and there's blood, but it's not that bloody. And like the scenes of them carrying him on the boards into the truck don't feel urgent in the way that a war movie sometimes does. And like there's intestines hanging out, it's just like he's just been shot, and he's still like mumbling and like kicking his blankets off.
Right. And it's even comical, like they're carrying on the boards and then suddenly they drop him and he like rolls down the road and
I mean it's exactly like a deer, right?
Yeah
he's just meat at that point.
Right. I think both stories have a real sense of characters that feel like life's not what it's supposed to be.
What do you mean?
Right. And with Anders, it's obvious. He's just at a point where everything is critical, and like clearly his life is not what he expected it to be, because right. you don't laugh at someone with a gun to your head unless your sort of sense of reality is sort of frustrating.
Right.
And I think we get a similar thing with Frank, where Frank has a very clear idea of what's normal and what he wants and what makes him happy, and he is right up against, obviously society's not into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this very violent reaction to that, right? In different ways.
Yeah.
Right? Frank chooses to basically commit murder, and Anders loses control and gets himself killed. But I don't know.
There's a feeling of teetering.
Yeah. On yeah. Yeah. Right?
They're all like teetering on the edge of like something awful, and it happens to them, all of them in some way.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So if there's a, if we have to, let's pick a winner. If there's a story fight here.
Oh boy.
Which do we like more?
Bullet in the Brain's a clear winner.
I would say too, yeah. The structural play of Bullet in the Brain and the surprise of it is, to me, more impressive than Hunters in the Snow, even though I like both those stories a lot.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've read a couple of his collections. These are the only two stories I remember. Hmm. And if you had asked me to pick one before we reread these, I would have picked Bullet in the Brain without a second thought.
Because
I think that's, of what I've read, his most memorable story.
Right.
For good reason.
Bullet is definitely clearer, more straightforward. The one I would want to reread is Hunters in the Snow, because I feel like there's a lot more going on than I understand through one or two reads.
Right.
So I want to revisit that one before I would revisit Bullet in the Brain.
Yeah, and they're good for different reasons. I think from a plot perspective, Hunter in the Snow is much more interesting. As we talked about, it asks a lot more questions, and there's more sort of layers of that onion to peel.
Yeah.
But I think just from a craft standpoint, from writing and maybe themes and stuff, I think Bone in the Brain is a very strong story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thinking back to our discussion about Stuart Dybbuk from earlier in episodes, whenever you heard it, or
Dave,
later, I don't know.
Dave calls him Stewie.
Stewie Dybbuk.
Stewie
Dybbuk. Dybeck? Dybbuk? Dybeck?
Stewie D.
He calls him SD. The sort of the tag of which would you want to have written, or which would you want to have your name on, I would have one I've written Bullet in the Brain.
Hmm.
I feel like that's what I would want to steal from this author.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's
you could maybe steal it, but change it a little bit so it's 60 minutes.
Would it be just one murder?
Yeah, one murder. Yeah, 60, yeah. 60 murders.
And 60 characters.
In 60 countries.
One thing that...
Also, it's written in 60 different languages.
Dear. You mean machine. One thing I would reread Bullet in the Brain, just because, speaking of Dybbuk and Coast to Chicago, there's a story in that collection called The Death of the Right Fielder, which is sort of it's a difficult story to, I guess, fully understand what he's getting at. I don't know how well you remember that one. But in the end, Anders is, as the bullet is going through his brain, as he's dying, the last image is of him standing in right field,
right,
thinking about this kid saying they is. So right. There's like, and in The Death of the Right Fielder, first theory that these kids have of why the right fielder, the kid is dead in right field, is that he was shot. So I'm curious to know if one is a comment on the other in some way. That, and I think that you said you think this Bullet in the Brain came out in the mid 90s.
I think it was 95.
Okay, so Dybbuk, I think Coast to Chicago came out in 91 ish.
Because I looked it up earlier.
91, really?
Feels like something like that.
I didn't realize it was.
But I guess we'd have to see where they were both originally. Oh, no, Wolf, New Yorker in the mid-90s. That's right.
Bullet in the Brain was New Yorker in 95, because that's where I read it.
So that was probably definitely then written after Dybbuk's. So is this a commentary on Death of the Right Fielder in some way, or like connected to it in any way? I would like to reread these two consecutively and really explore that and see if there's anything there.
Yeah.
And then probably be frustrated in the end because there's nothing there. Or if there is, I'm too stupid to figure it out.
Yeah.
But if it's an excuse to read Coast of Chicago again, then I will take it.
Yeah, exactly.
We probably should just go ahead and do the whole book at some point, right?
Yeah, we probably should.
Yeah, I haven't read it.
That'd be great. So you should read it.
Yeah, the whole book.
We're doing Frankenstein first, though.
There's a story or two we could skip in the middle that we'll talk about, but...
we've got some stuff coming up. So this is our first story club. We got some... what do we got? Amy Bender coming up, right?
Yeah, so our next one, we're going to read three stories.
Yeah.
Amy Bender's The Rememberer, Amelia Gray's The Darkness, and Stephen Milhauser's A Visit. And we'll throw links up to those on our Twitter.
Yeah. Do you want to talk just real super quick about why these three are together, what we're going to be looking for?
Yeah, we're going to be looking at fabulism and how that works and how it doesn't, and maybe why we don't see a lot of it.
Down the line, Murakami at some point, right? We discussed that.
Yeah, he was on the list for that series, too. So depending on where that goes, we might dig up some Murakami and some others.
Yeah.
Maybe Marquez.
Yeah, definitely.
Angel.
lots of stuff down the line.
So that'll be our next one. You can also follow along with our comics podcast, where we're talking about Paper Girls and Shade the Changing Girl. We're on issues
3 and 4.
So both of those for our next issue, our episode.
Keep up with those. We'll be talking about them. And then, of course, follow us on Twitter at YakBabies, and then email us at YakBabiesPodcast@gmail.com with whatever you want. Thoughts, reviews, reactions.
Except racist stuff.
Don't do that. But whatever it is, we'll be happy to hear it and then engage with it. That's what we're looking for. Anything else, gentlemen? Wrap it up?
That's it.
YakBabies, yakking off.